WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing this program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Henry Frain is at the controls. In this hour, we will be talking with Hendrik Hertzberg. He is a staff writer and editor at The New Yorker and has been there at the magazine since 1992. In fact, before that, he was also a staff writer in the early 70s. He's been a reporter for Newsweek magazine. He was the chief speech writer for President Jimmy Carter and also editor at The New Republic and has written a lot about American politics over the last 40-odd years. Right now, he's got a new book out that is a collection of some of his writings going back to the mid-60s and includes everything from Vietnam on the one end to 9/11 on the other and a lot of stuff in between. Most of it is about politics, but also some of it is about American culture, popular and otherwise. The title of the book is Politics, Observations and Arguments, 1966 to 2004, and it's published by the Penguin Press. It's out there in the bookstore now if you're interested in looking at it. And of course, as we talk in this part of Focus 580, questions, comments are certainly welcome if you'd like to talk with our guest. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, it would be a long-distance call, or you might be happen to be listening over the Internet. As long as you're in the United States, you can use that toll-free line. Again, it's a local 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Hertzberg, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, delighted to do it.
We appreciate it. I hope you'll forgive such a sweeping question just to start out with. But, you know, given the fact that you have been writing about politics for a long time, and there are pieces in this book about a number of presidents, Mr. Carter, Mr. Reagan, the two Messrs. Bush, Mr. Clinton, and so forth. Is it possible to say something about how politics in America has changed over the last few decades, or what important ways it's changed?
Wow, that's a tall order. Yeah, it probably is possible to say a few things about it. I think it's gotten harder. I think it's gotten more demanding of politicians and of citizens. It's gotten meaner. We've had a polarization that's built gradually. I guess it really kind of kicked into high gear about 25 years ago. And that was something that political scientists had always hoped for. They wanted coherent political parties that presented starkly contrasting views, but now that we've got it, we're not sure that it's such a wonderful thing to have gotten. And then the massive changes that have been introduced by the change in the media. So it's probably easier to list the continuities than the changes. I mean, there are fewer of them.
It certainly seems that the kind of conversations that we have. And maybe, again, this goes back to changes in the media. Conversations we have about politics and political issues are superficial, to say the least, and that we spend far too much time talking about the wrong things. But
yeah,
is that so different than it's ever been? I guess that's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, I'm not totally convinced that that's particularly different from the past. It's just it's much more amplified. And the kind of conversations that people used to have in coffee shops or on over backyard fences, a lot of them now are on the radio. And so they're in our face in a way that they weren't when we were having them ourselves and having them rarely. Now, if you want to, you can listen to that kind of ignorant jabber all day long. But whether there's more ignorant jabber than now than there was then, or if it's just more of it's in front of a microphone now, I tend to think it's more the latter than the former.
Mm. And one of the essays you're writing about now, maybe our preoccupation with the issue of character, I'm not sure that it's, again, it's all very deep, but that, you know, we're told that character matters and we're given all this stuff about candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly those things that their campaigns think will play well. But then at the end of the day, I find myself asking, well, what exactly do we know about them? I guess I think about your comment that if Franklin Roosevelt was running for office today, all of his staffers would wear little gold wheelchair pins and in their lapels, we would fixate on that, and that somehow would become, you know, the fact that he was disabled, but he managed to overcome that. That would be emblematic of his character, and yet you wonder, well, what exactly does something like that mean?
You know, like, there you go. I mean, and maybe it would be emblematic of his character. I mean, it certainly does. It's certainly interesting that he overcame. He was struck in adulthood by polio and put in a wheelchair. As a grown-up, I mean, he'd already been a nominee, Democratic nominee for vice president, when he caught polio, and went into the wheelchair. But this whole tsunami of speculation about candidates' character is not exactly new, but the quality of it and the amount of it is new. Part of it comes from the fact that because we have television and radio, we're exposed to the candidates in an intimate way that we weren't certainly in the 19th century. And increasingly, you know, as the quality of television gets better, we feel we know these people better and better. In the 19th century, before television, before radio, everything you knew about a presidential candidate, unless you happened to be one of the few thousand people who'd actually met the person, was from print, from word of mouth, from drawings, perhaps, if that's the only way you'd know what the person looked like. You'd have no idea what the person's voice sounded like. You'd have no intimate knowledge. You'd have to rely on the person's public record. Now, we're in a kind of misleadingly intimate terms with our political candidates. We think that we know them a lot better than we do. And, you know, if you consider your own friends and or acquaintances and how sometimes they will surprise you, we don't know them. We looking for secrets, looking for some kind of secret key to their character is, I think, a fool's game. And that's what all the family and sex stuff is about. It's a kind of vulgar Freudianism where we are trying to find a key to a candidate's, a public man or woman's character that isn't there somehow, or we imagine isn't there on their public record. I think it is there on their public record.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Henry Kurtzberg. He's a staff writer and editor at The New Yorker magazine. Also has worked for Newsweek and for The New Republic, was a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter. He has a book out now that collects some of his writing, some of it from The New Yorker, but also other places, that goes back to the mid-60s. Politics, Observations and Arguments, 1966 through 2004, published by the Penguin Press. It's in bookstores now. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. When I was reading the piece, one of the early pieces of the book that you wrote about Vietnam, right away, one of the things I started thinking about and knew that I wanted to ask you about was the role that Vietnam is playing in this year's presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I think that inevitably, for politicians of the generation that came of age between, say, 1963 and 1970, it's going to be an important question, because every young man in that era faced some sort of a choice regarding that war. Now, unless one happened to be have some physical disability, some obvious physical disability that made one ineligible for service, then it was a matter of choice what you did. Not entirely a matter of choice, but I think that it makes sense to look at what people did, what young men did in those days, as a clue to what sort of person they are and were. We certainly did it. We went over Bill Clinton's record with a fine-tooth comb, and I think it's a little too simple to say, well, Bill Clinton was a draft dodger. Bill Clinton grappled with the question of the Vietnam War in a serious way. And if things had fallen out a bit different, I think he would have ended up in the service. In any event, he was serious enough about it to have been involved in the anti-war movement. I think that if you weren't involved in either the military or the anti-war movement, then presumptively one can say that you weren't serious. That's true of say Dick Cheney. It's certainly not true of John Kerry. I mean, John Kerry was very seriously involved in both fighting the war and protesting the war, and that's why I think he passes those tests set by the Vietnam War with flying colors. But we could certainly argue over how relevant that is to what kind of president he would be now.
There's some controversy surrounding his record now. He was decorated, and a lot of people consider him a hero, including men who served with him, and they've been willing to stand up in public and say so. Now there are also some others who question whether or not the account he gave of what happened was correct, and did he deserve those medals, and it seemed, at least in part, to be motivated by the fact that when he came back, he turned against the war. It's kind of hard to sort the partisan stuff
entirely,
out.
I'd say entirely, 100% by that. Mm. And, you know, let's not mince words. This is a truly disgusting smear campaign that's being conducted. It makes the Willie Horton commercial look like child's play. It is grotesque and disgusting. And the... I mean, it just makes me sputter with rage. The fact that it can now be described, it can now be said that there's something controversial about John Kerry's service in Vietnam is testimony to the success of the smear campaign. And there's nothing controversial about it. There's no controversy here. There's a smear campaign that will succeed, probably has succeeded, in making people who don't pay particularly close attention think that, oh yeah, well, I heard there was something funny about Kerry's that Vietnam thing. There's something wrong with it. I heard there's something wrong with it. That's the purpose of this, is to muddy it up a bit and to tarnish it, and to, it's pure dirty politics, nothing more, nothing less.
And you think that that's actually worked?
Yes. I think that it is working. I mean, I think that it's designed to influence a rather narrow segment of the electorate that doesn't pay particularly close attention, that doesn't draw much of a distinction between what it sees on a news broadcast or in a nominal news broadcast and what is seen in a commercial or a paid advertisement, and that thinks superficially about such things. And I think that this campaign is successful in muddying up Kerry, and that's what it's designed to do.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone listening in Urbana, so let's do that. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I simply want to thank you for denouncing the Kerry smear, and would like to point out that this has been investigated several times by leading newspapers over, the last 20 years, and been found to be completely false and bogus.
That's right, and it's just it's just a hell of a note, you know. If these veterans, the ones from the or allegedly from the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth outfit, were actually interested in truth, then they might be examining the military records of both presidential candidates. After all, that's the choice we have. The choice we have is not between John Kerry, who was a 100% total unmitigated hero, and John Kerry, who was only a 95% hero. Our choice is between John Kerry and George W. Bush.
Am I right in supposing that the people that are perpetrating this are the same people who did the bogus survey in North Carolina during the primary there a few years back, where they inquired if a person would still support Senator McClain if it were known that he had fathered a black child, which of course he hadn't.
No, he'd adopted an Indian child, and I would not stake my life on this, but I am fairly, I have read that that yes, the financing of this is, comes from the same source, and of course, John McCain has denounced these ads as dishonest and dishonorable, and called on Bush to do likewise, which he has not done.
It infuriates me that the news people continue to present this as a question when it has been thoroughly repudiated. They're just playing into the hands of the worst element of the smear groups.
When you have this sort of big lie politics, it puts the news media on the spot in a way that's very uncomfortable for them, because it takes quite a leap to write in a news story that to report what a politician has said and then to point out that what the politician has said is not true. It kind of goes against the conventions of news reporting, which are you don't say directly that something is a lie. You go and find somebody on the other side and quote that person as saying it's a lie. Some reporters have been little by little trying to do this, and pointing out when a statement is made. I have to say that generally these statements have been made on the Bush side, not the Kerry side, but pointing out when such a statement is simply false. There are a couple of websites devoted to this too. Columbia Journalism Review has a campaign watch website that actually tracks the truth and untruth of what is being said on the campaign trail.
Other questions, comments certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. As I mentioned a couple of times, you spent some time working as a speechwriter for President Carter, and there's a piece, I think is actually one of the longer pieces in the book, that you wrote about Mr. Carter. I guess one of the things I'm interested in, and I think about him and what he has done since he's been president, and what other former presidents have done. Is there something interesting, something significant we can learn by looking at what presidents do in their retirement?
Well, there is. It can shed light on their presidency. It can't change it can't really change one's final judgment about their presidency. Just being a great ex-president does not somehow turn you retrospectively into having been a great president. You can look, you deserve a president who uses his ex-presidency creatively, as Jimmy Carter has done, deserves credit for that. There are a few other ex-presidents that have used their ex-presidency in a creative way. Certainly John Quincy Adams did, Herbert Hoover did. William Howard Taft, who became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, did. Carter is probably the best of them all, but that doesn't mean he's the best. He was the best president of them all. You can look at the record of an ex-president, and it can tell you, it can help you interpret his record as president and separate the wheat from the chaff figure out which qualities he seemed to show as president were inherent qualities and which were either wrong perceptions or qualities that only emerged good and bad under the pressure of the presidency. But the fact that somebody is a good ex-president doesn't confer any particular merit retrospectively on his presidency.
Let's talk with someone else. Caller in Chicago, line number 4, our toll-free line.
Yes, I have a question on another topic, but first regarding the Swift boat. I believe the president has called for and abolishing all these outside groups who make these type of ads, and I guess that would include on the other side too.
That's a procedural thing. He needs to denounce the specifics. He needs to denounce the substance of this ad, not all ads, including the ones that are promoted on his own behalf.
But I think it does work both ways. And if they make Michael Moore a celebrity at the Democratic convention, well, then they're responsible too for that type of thing.
They didn't make Michael Moore a celebrity at the Democratic
convention. I believe
He was there. He couldn't prevent him from showing up.
Well,
he had no official role in the convention, and he's no more part of the.
He was sitting next to President Carter. I mean, he had a good seating position anyway, but. I mean, he's treated as a celebrity by Democrats. So I guess it works both ways, in other words. I had a question actually on another point.
Sure.
It had to do with George Soros, who's financing a lot of the anti-Bush material going around today. And I've heard that, and I don't know if it's true or not, but perhaps you would know, that he's heavily involved in the overseas abortion industry. And I've heard that he has a string of abortion clinics in Eastern Europe. Is that correct, or have you heard the same thing?
No, I haven't. I think that's false. His money, I mean, the billions, comes from arbitrage. I mean, he's only ever been, as far as I know, in one business, and that's the business of investment and basically currency speculation.
Right. I know he's an investment banker, and he has investments. I had heard that this was one of his investments. I wasn't sure if that was correct or not. I didn't want to,
I don't think so. His involvement in Eastern Europe is very much to the point, though, because he did as much as maybe any individual human being, apart from maybe the Pope, to bring down communism in Eastern Europe. I mean, the Solidarity in Poland was much of its financing came from George Soros, financing of a lot of the civic groups in Eastern Europe came from George Soros, and his money helped cushion the shock of the change when the Soviet Empire collapsed. He is a hero of anti-communism.
He's involved in the currency speculation, I hear. Is it true that he was involved in the devaluation of the British pound? Is that what is the connection?
Well, what arbitrageurs do is to try to figure out which way a currency is going, up or down, and then they kind of bet against that currency or bet in favor of a currency they think is going up. Some people blame Soros for the decline in the British pound. Others think that, well, it was the market what done it, and George Soros was just the guy who was smart enough to figure out which way the market was going.
I understand. Well, thanks for your information.
All right, let's go back here to someone in local, Champaign County, line 1.
Hi, good morning. Are you following the case of this Mohammed Naeem Noor, the computer whiz in Pakistan? I'm absolutely frustrated the way it's being presented, because the story that you can read in the British press is that the guy was a mole. He'd been turned, and he was actually communicating with Al-Qaeda on the very day that his cover was blown. I heard Michael Isikoff saying, well, the Pakistanis, according to the New York Times, supposedly blew his cover. But my understanding is that was after it was his name was revealed in background by the highest levels of this administration, and it was used to justify the heightening of the alert, and it seems to me that it's an extreme example of I don't like to call it a war on terrorism, but going after Al-Qaeda suffering because of, well, anyway, maybe you can elucidate it in what you found out if you're following that story.
I have not been following that case. It sounds interesting, and I'm sure that it's being followed at our magazine, at the New Yorker.
I hope so, because it seems to be, like I say, a guy from Time can say that, well, the Pakistanis revealed it when... it's pretty clear it was revealed in the aftermath of the announcement, and the British and the Pakistani intelligence services are supposedly absolutely furious. You know, now they're applauding the roundup of these guys that went to court this morning in England, mm-hmm. but they actually, were prematurely had to round them up early because they had an operation going on. And it's okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, let's go on to another caller here. This is Champagne's line number two. Hello.
Hi. First of all, you really let the caller two callers ago go by. He's talking about funding this Soros person funding abortion clinics and being a currency speculator. What a sham! That guy was just a shill for the Republican Party. There's no question about it. Abortion rights. There we are. We're talking about that. We're talking about basically Jews. That's the code word for money changer for a financial speculator. And you didn't call him on it. I think you should have.
No, you're absolutely you're right. Of course, he was reading off Republican talking points
exactly.
about Soros.
Exactly. So,
it riles me because Soros did more to bring down communism than any of these Republican talking point characters.
Well, a friendly jab then. Don't let people like that slide by. You knew he was talking about right off the Republican talking points, and you shouldn't have let him go on that. But set that aside.
Well, I think I tried to answer the substance of what he was saying.
You were very gentle. I wanted to talk a little bit about profiteering.
My bedside manner.
I want to talk a little bit about profiteering with the Iraqi war. One of the things that I've read recently is every so often the military industrial complex needs a war to what they call is blooding the weapon systems. And we haven't had a blooding since the early 90s. The first Gulf War was a good chance to blood some of the weapon systems that were developed in the 70s and 80s after the Vietnam era. And after the Gulf War I, there was a huge acceleration of research and development and so on, and that there's some talk that this war is primarily driven by the military-industrial complex that needs to blood the new generation of weapon systems. During some of the early days of the war, the Gulf War II, there was the big military weapons expo that happened to be, I think it was United African Emirates.
Mm-hmm.
We're somewhere right in that neighborhood, but basically 100 or a couple hundred miles away from the action in Iraq, and they were showcasing the war for the weapons for the next generation that were going to be based a lot on how well weapons performed here in Iraq. Any comment about that and the connections that the Bush administration has to the industrial military complex? And I'll just listen offline.
Sure. I think that that's barking up a wrong tree. I don't think that this war, either the war in Iraq or the war on terror, are caused by a military industrial complex that wants to try out its new toys. That may be, they may take advantage of the conflict to do that, which is only natural. But the uniformed military has not been particularly enthusiastic. I mean, the high command of the uniformed military has not been particularly enthusiastic about the Iraq war. And I think the basic urges behind the Iraq war do not come from that kind of source. They're not economic. They're ideological and political. And I think it might be comforting to think that all our troubles, that if we could just kind of damp down the military-industrial complex, then we'd never have any more wars and never have any more conflicts and never have anything more to worry about. But I think that that's mistaking the effect for the cause.
Hmm. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And again, let me introduce our guest. We're talking with Hendrik Hertzberg. He's a staff writer and editor at The New Yorker magazine, has been there since 1992. He was also staff writer there in the early 70s. He's been a reporter for Newsweek. He was editor at The New Republic and also spent some time as a speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter. And there's now a book out that's a collection of some of his writing going back to the mid-60s about politics and other aspects of American life. And the title of the book is Politics, Observations and Arguments, 1966 to 2004. The Penguin Press is the publisher, and it's in the bookstore now. On the way to war, the Bush administration gave a number of justifications, including weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. And now that seems to have fallen away, and what we're left with is liberation. The administration continues to, the president continues to say, well, even knowing what he knows now, he would do it over again. Often when people question the war, the response from the right is, well, you know, would you rather have Saddam Hussein there, and aren't the people of Iraq better off? And it may take some time to answer a question like that, but I guess I wonder whether, if eventually we get some point at some point where we could say, yes, the people of Iraq are better off, does that mean that the war was right? Would that mean that the war had been right?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think the people of Iraq probably are better off. Maybe definitely are better off, and I hope that they will be better off. I hope that Iraq will not descend into a kind of anarchy that would put them in worse shape than they were under Saddam Hussein. I doubt that that will happen. But that doesn't mean that the war was worth the cost. The resources that went into this war were not available for other uses. We've neglected the war on Al Qaeda. We did not finish the job in Afghanistan. There is a great deal of good we could do around the world with the kind of blood and money that we've expended in Iraq. It's the fact that the Iraqis are better off does not mean that another set of people, or even the Iraqis themselves, might be better off had we expended our efforts in a different way. We've also damaged our credibility. The next time we cry wolf about weapons of mass destruction, we're gonna be met with doubt, both at home and abroad. I mean, this is the government's word is not its bond, and that is a tremendous cost of this war. It's important to our national security that when the government says there is a mortal danger coming from a certain source, that it be believed and that it be true. And so being the kind of carelessness with facts that was demonstrated in the run-up to the Iraq War is just incredibly damaging to our national security.
You were one of those people who, after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, reacted to the way it was being talked about, all the war metaphors. Mm-hmm. And I think you were one of those people who said, no, this is the wrong way to think about this and to talk about it. This is not Pearl Harbor. What we have here is a criminal action of spectacular proportions, but that, and that we ought to think about it that way and respond to it that way.
There are things wrong with every metaphor, and there's the war metaphor has traps. It kind of conditions us to a certain kind of action. The reason I suggest the crime metaphor as a better one for this is that these are stateless outlaws that conducted this this horrible atrocity, and they operate. They may find refuge in rogue states, and they may get assistance from rogue states, but this isn't the kind of war that you can win the way we usually think of as wars being won, with a massed army defeating another massed army. The people who actually perpetrate the deeds of September 11th and future September 11th are not armies operated by states. They are rather small groups of people who may have large political support, who may be heroes to millions of people, the way Dillinger was a hero to millions of people, the way Willie Sutton was a hero to millions of people. But they don't represent the kind of enemies that the word war suggests to us we're up against. I mean, the problem with the crime metaphor is that it may make it seem less urgent, may make the whole task seem less urgent than it should seem, because the task is as urgent as the task of war. So some mixture of these two metaphors is what we ought to be focusing on. And I noticed that President Bush himself said the other day that war on terror was the wrong description. And then he gave a very long description, which has been made fun of, but it actually was pretty accurate, something to the effect of war on militant Islamic terrorism that may sometimes work with rogue states to try to get weapons of mass destruction into the wrong hands, something like that. It was a bit long for everyday use, but more accurate than the simple war on terror metaphor, which I think clearly has led us up some blind alleys, Iraq being the blindest.
Well, we have some other people who would like to get in here to the program. Let's get back to the phones. We have a caller up next in Savoy, line one. Yes, sir.
The previous caller made a point of pointing out that the caller asking questions about George Soros was nothing more than a Republican shill. And after explaining why he thought that was the case, he then went on to talk as if he was reading from Democratic campaign points, talking points. So I wonder if that person was not just a Democratic shill. And, what is the level of duty of care that a guest on a radio station has to try to figure who's who when it's a very politically charged season?
Well, you're right about that, and I think actually, my instinct is to deal with the substance of what people say,
right,
rather than to try and figure out whether they're reading off of a list of talking points from one party or the other. And after all, these talking points do become part of the dialogue,
mm-hmm.
and they need to be discussed and answered on their own substance and not simply dismissed because they happen to be in the service of one party or the other.
Now, I hope I don't sound like or be accused of a Republican show, because I'm not, but I think the story of the career of George Soros and all of his financial dealings cannot be clearly summarized in even probably a one-hour show.
Mm-hmm.
But the one comment that I do have is that I think if the future of this country's election process is going to be in increasing amounts influenced by billionaires from foreign nations or quasi-state/private/public corporations from around the world, then we're in for a lot of trouble, because the political motivations behind these individuals or organizations or companies can be directly in opposite to the security and the well-being of the United States.
Well, George Soros is an American citizen, as is Arnold Schwarzenegger and any number of other American citizens. You bring up the question of undue influence exercised by billionaires, and that's surely a legitimate question. And we have George Soros, we have Richard Scaife, we have the Rockefellers, we've got lots and lots of we have Bill Gates. There are lots of people who accumulate. There are people who accumulate lots of money and use it in various ways. And that deserves to be, in fact, it's important for that to be out in public and examined where we can see it.
Good point, and appreciate that response. And then just one last final point was, with respect to the way that our nation may or may not have exposed a certain level type of informative source on the movements of Al-Qaeda in a political season seems, you know, if the source had not been revealed or the reasons why we were going to such an alert had not been explained as fully as they were, then there would always be some that would be accusing the administration of raising the alert for purely political purposes rather than based upon information on the ground. And then if you start revealing too much information about those sources, then yes, other allies, and perhaps we do compromise our position, but I just think I don't think it's a good thing that the whole issue has to be played as a political ploy by anybody.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that that we should be discussing the wisdom of the overall policies. I mean, what's useful in deciding who ought to be the next president is not the tiny details of spy craft that this represents. I mean, of course, if somebody were revealing, were blowing a secret operation in order for some momentary political gain, that would be worth knowing about. But the real issue is what overall policies and approaches would a President Kerry take, and vis-a-vis what a President Bush would take, and that's what that's the useful thing to be focusing on.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, just real quick to go to the presidential contest that's going on right now. It seems like that for some time now we have been told there have been substantial numbers of voters who said that they identify as Democrats or Republicans or red and blue people or Kerry supporters or Bush supporters or whatever, and that those things haven't changed and are not likely to change. And so we're led to believe that the outcome of this election could be decided by a very small number of people who haven't really made up their minds. If that's true, what do you think it will be that will get those people to go either one way or another? I mean, what do you think are the most important issues for the undecided voters?
Well, there are of course two sets of people who could decide a close election. There are the undecided voters who haven't made up their minds, and then there are the sort of demotivated voters who, if they did vote, it's clear which way they would vote, but they don't feel like bothering to vote. In other words, the unmobilized parts of each party's base. And both parties seem to be actually stressing more going for the undecided voter, the voter in the center, rather than, but they're also doing a lot to motivate their bases. So they're following both strategies at once, most of their rhetoric is aimed at the undecided voter, and most of their kind of organizing work is aimed at the base voter. So they're doing both at once. In the Republican convention that's coming up, they're putting their most moderate face on display. Obviously, they think that the kind of hard right Tom DeLay approach is a loser when it comes to the undecided voters. So they're putting people like George Pataki and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Rudy Giuliani up as their public face, just as the Democrats stressed military credentials. They had former generals up there. They did not stress their anti-war pacifist side at all. Thinking that that's a loser when it comes to the undecided voters. So both parties are making a rhetorical play for the center, where those undecided voters are believed to be.
That's interesting in that it seems that so often people, when you talk about what the strategies of the party should be, is there's this criticism that the parties, and I think particularly you hear this about the Democratic Party, is it's not being true to its nature. It's trying to be something other than that what it is, and that if they really want to be successful, it seems that they ought to appeal even more strongly to their base. But that's not what they're doing, and in fact, maybe that's not the way that you win elections.
it's an unending debate, but I think that purists need to understand that a lot of that kind of political positioning that goes on is just absolutely necessary given the kind of political arrangements that we have. It's a winner-take-all, a zero-sum game here, you've got to somehow put together more votes than the other guy, and quite a lot more votes, as we now know. Just getting a few more votes than the other guy isn't enough. You've got to put it beyond stealing distance. And sometimes that requires building a bigger tent and letting some people into it that you might not be comfortable with.
Let me just ask you about one other thing, and I got some callers here. I want to try to get in a couple of people more. But just because in the book you have some pieces about proportional representation.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one of these ideas that from time to time is discussed, and a lot of people feel that would make a big difference in American politics. Difficult to achieve because I expect that the Republicans and Democrats would resist such a thing. But an idea nonetheless that in a quiet but continuing way people can keep talking about. How do you think that would change things?
Well, I think actually Illinois is one of the few places in the United States where something along these lines has actually been tried. I mean, the Illinois legislature used to have cumulative voting, in other words, which is a form. It's one of the many forms of proportional representation where essentially you had three-member legislative districts. And generally, unless one party got an overwhelming, 90 or 80% majority, generally that would mean that one party would get two and the other party would get one in each three-member district. And that had a lot of positive effects. It meant there was a lot more bipartisanship. It meant higher voter turnout, because when you went in to vote, even if you were in a district that was overwhelmingly Republican or overwhelmingly Democrat, and you were the other party, you still had a shot at some representation. So you didn't give up majority rule, but you still had representation of political minorities. The cumulative voting, I won't go into the details of how it worked, and a lot of Illinois people already know how it worked, but it's an illustration of the fact that a lot of different things could be tried out on the state level without changing the federal constitution, and they should be. There's no reason why every single state government should be a mindless Xerox of the federal government, with a House, a Senate, and a governor, all separately elected, all from single-member districts. Try some other things. I mean, the world is full of interesting ways to organize democratic governments. Europe has got, there are probably 15 or 20 different ways of doing it in Europe alone. They're all variations on proportional representation that end up give you different outcomes. You can engineer it any way you like, but we ought to be experimenting with these things on the state level.
Let's talk with another caller here. Chicago, line number 4.
Yeah, hi. I've long appreciated your writing in both the New Republican and the New Yorker.
Oh, thank you.
Over the years. One of the reasons that I called, there are two points I want to get to. Well, at least the first one is that it seems to me that if one were to read Robert Caro's three volumes of his LBJ biography, one would get to understand how the Republican Party operates. That is, Johnson is the guy who made the Brown brothers, who controlled Brown and Root, multimillionaires, and they in turn made him political leader that he eventually became, but by his support, by their support of him and their gathering a clique of reactionary industrialists in Texas to back him all the way through to the presidency. Uh-huh. In any case, the book illustrates how elections were stolen in Texas and how they gained control of Texas. And after Johnson had his civil rights bills enacted, they became the core of the Republican Party in Texas, and they're the bunch of gangsters, basically, who back the president and control the government in the United States. Now, Brown and Root became part of Halliburton, and their method of operation is essentially the same now as it was in Texas. The stealing of funds and that sort of thing, corruption through and through.
And your other point?
My other point is the question about the article that Seymour Hersh authored in his January article regarding the
Abu Ghraib prison.
No, this was the about the bunch that that essentially wanted to get us into war and the setting up of by the War Department
I'm going to have to jump in here on the call. I have to apologize. We're just at the end of the time, and we're just going to have to stop. I don't know if there's any last sort of thought that you'd like to offer before we go. There's an awful lot in the book and an awful lot one could talk about. And I would certainly encourage people to go out and look at the book because there's a lot of good pieces in there.
Well, I would certainly second that.
Maybe we'll just have to leave it at that. Again, I hope that the last caller will forgive me for having to do that. I'm just really sorry. Sometimes you come to the end and you simply have to stop.
Of course.
Our guest, Hendrik Hertzberg, staff writer at The New Yorker since 1992. He's also written for Newsweek, The New Republic. The book is Politics, Observations, and Arguments, 1966-2004, The Penguin Press. And again, Mr. Hertzberg, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ring. I really appreciate it.
This show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Support for the broadcast also comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine in Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the series collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings held every Friday from 6 to 8 and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. That's it for us. We want you to stay tuned, though. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with journalist Eugene Robinson of the Washington Post. We'll talk with him about his new book, Last Dance in Havana, The Final Days of Fidel and the Start of the New Cuban Revolution. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening on the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. September wheat trading at 303, that down 5 3/4. December 316.5, down 6. September corn 226.